When I left Vienna, I left for Prague. It was an experience just getting into Prague. I remember for the first time, as I said, up until this time, I was treated as a very important person, and my bags were hustled through, and I was given all kinds of special attention by guards and dignitaries. But on this occasion, crossing the border to Czechoslovakia was a different situation. The guards, I remember, treated me with absolute efficiency, but were totally thorough. They inspected every inch of my luggage. They inspected every inch of me. I realized that I was crossing into a different world. When I arrived in Prague, the people were different. There was a negativism, a sadness, a quietness about everybody. There was a terrible black market, by the way. Everybody was being watched. And there was the Joint Distribution Committee office was run by a Mr. Levine. I don't remember him very well, but I can tell you that he operated, at least it was my observation, that he operated very quietly and with substantial limitations because of the communists. Certainly there was not the freedom. They tolerated us because we provided dollar exchange. We were able to pay for things in American dollars, and that's what made it possible for us to operate. The best experience, of course, was visiting the Jewish cemetery and the Jewish the new old synagogue or old new synagogue. Everybody has done that since, but that was quite a new experience at that time.
Naya Altenschul.
Yeah, right, Naya Altenschul. I then made it a point to, through my contacts at the joint office, to contact this person that I had talked about, who had been talked to me about in Capri. And her name was Hanna Yelenkova. And I remember we went out to dinner. She was a very attractive young woman. And I told her, she was very reluctant to talk to me on any subject that had to do about anything outside the borders of Czechoslovakia. So I realized that it was very dangerous to even broach the subject of leaving Prague at that time. However, I was young and brash, and I didn't care very much about, I thought I was invincible, so I proceeded to say that I wanted her to go with me to England. And she, of course, turned me down. It turns out that is my wife here? Yeah, she is. It turns out, years later I learned that she had a boyfriend, she got married, she stayed in Prague, she didn't want to go to England. Nonetheless, I did eventually go to see her family in England. They invited me and were very nice. It was a very nice arrangement. But that was, to me at that time as a young man, was a very important experience to realize that what one, how people could help each other, do things for each other, just to save a life. From Prague, I left for Munich. I don't remember the man's name in Munich, but I do remember that he gave me a book of photographs of the Holocaust. And would you know that somewhere that was stolen from me? And I don't have it, and regretted that all my life. Pictures that we see now commonly that have been made part of the Holocaust Museum and so forth. I really had my own copy of all those photographs. I then went to, and of course in Munich, and I did see, I didn't mention, I have to go back. When I was in Prague, I was taken to see Theresienstadt. And Theresienstadt. Theresien was the camp just outside of Czechoslovakia. And that was a shocking experience. They say that Theresa Stout was one of the better of the concentration camps.
Best.
But at that time, I didn't think very much of it. I guess everything in life is relevant, and compared to Auschwitz, it probably was. But it was a pretty treacherous place. I saw the torture chambers and the place with the wall where they shot people and all the spent bullets and the blood spattered on the wall against which they were tied, the poles and so forth that you see in the movies. I saw the dispensaries where people were ill-treated rather than treated. I did have the opportunity to meet with survivors who were doctors who told me stories about some of the bad treatment that people had received at that time, or no treatment at all. Question of how pregnancy was handled was very bad. Women were left to suffer without any treatment. Childbed fever was commonplace. It was, if Theresa Stout was considered the best, it certainly was as bad as I could imagine anything could be.
Were there still Jewish people in the camp?
No, nobody would stay in the camp. But I want to just make a comment about that, because the driver, as I said, every place that I visited, every community, every capital that I visited, I was assigned a driver. And the driver assigned to me in Prague had been a prisoner in Theresienstadt. And this was something that everybody talked about, but I had the opportunity to see it firsthand. He absolutely denied that any of these things existed. He absolutely had total blockage of what had gone on before, though he had scars, he had been beaten, the head of the Prague office, Levine, told me the stories about him. They salvaged him, they rehabilitated him, they gave him a job, and in all the joint offices, they used survivors to provide jobs. So that he was another example of that, totally rejected any thought, had blocked out of his mind any thought that he had been tortured or anything bad had happened to him. I then, as I pointed out, I went to Munich, and in Munich, I was taken to see Dachau. I remember in Dachau the awful experience of seeing what had gone on there. This was not long afterwards. Now these places are cleaned up and dressed up, but in 1948, when I was there, nothing had changed. It was 2 years since the war, and nobody had any money to do anything with anything. So nothing was a monument. Everything was just as it was left the day that our American army moved in and freed that camp. As a matter of fact, there were even papers laying around, strewn around in the dispensary. I remember picking up from the floor an autopsy report from an experimentation, of course written in German. I think I still have that filed somewhere. From there I went to Frankfurt. I don't have much recollection of Frankfurt. That was somehow blocking in my mind. And then back to Paris. I arrived in Paris on June 7th, so I had been on the road about close to 2 months, and then left for England. I went to England primarily because I had been invited to do that by this family, the Kellners. Just a word about that experience. England had won the war, but had much less to eat than any place in Europe, so that there was very little food around, even for those who could afford it. Whereas in France and Italy, not so much Germany, but in France and Italy, food was available. It was just a question of who could afford to pay for it, and paying for it for an American was simple. Two cigarettes got you a meal. One cigarette got your laundry done. It was when I would descend from a train, I remember that there would be fist fights over my baggage, who was going to carry my baggage. So these were experiences one young man will never forget, even though it is almost 50 years ago.
Can't imagine the emotional impact of this on you.
Yeah. I went to England and was treated royally, but let me just tell you that how bad things were in retrospect, that the family that invited me had arranged for a dinner in my honor, and they had saved their entire allotment of eggs for a month so that they could have this dinner. And they provided for me every day an egg, and I wasn't really aware that the reason that they weren't eating eggs was not because they didn't like eggs, as they said. I suddenly became aware from a friend of theirs that they had saved all their eggs so that I could eat eggs. In those days we ate eggs. I don't eat eggs today, but in those days it was common to have eggs for breakfast. But this, they received, I think, 2 eggs per week. That was an unusual experience going to that. They were in the north of England. I liked that and enormously. It was a beautiful country. I did go to London and then back. I sailed from London to the United States on the Queen Mary.
Do you have any summary thoughts, particularly in regard to the salient effects or incidents at the actual, Dachau and Theresienstadt? I think you've mentioned some of it.
Well, when I was there, nobody was there. It was wind blowing across the field. There was nothing salient except the view and the realization. And of course, as I said, wherever I went, I had my own personal tour guide and my own chauffeur. Very unique experience. Mm-hmm. You know, we think in terms today, if you did that, it would cost you $100 for the car and $100 for the guide. And I think maybe the guide, what it cost joint to supply that for me was minuscule. It was all supplied, and of course, joint, it was an opportunity for me to be able to go back and talk about all these things. I'm sorry that I didn't read up on some of my notes about these things, and perhaps before we meet again I will do that and make some other comments, but I don't have any. On the business of going to Czechoslovakia at that time, I remember how it was possible. It was possible because we had an organization that we worked together with, that is the joint, worked with what was called the International Refugee Organization. So when I went to Czechoslovakia, the communist government would not allow me into Czechoslovakia based on the joint, even though they were permitted to operate, but it was on the basis of the International Refugee Organization. Russia wanted to maintain its foothold in the international organization, the United Nations, and therefore they had to cooperate. So it was on that basis. So I had papers which were called travel orders for the IRO, travel author. Here are the papers. Mm-hmm. I just remember that. Travel authorization. And it says, for the International Refugee to Prague, Czechoslovakia from Vienna.
Were you aware at that time of Slansky and his government? Rudolf Slansky.
Oh, you mean
in Czechoslovakia?
Oh, yes, of course, absolutely.
What were you aware of?
Well, I had realized what had happened because just before I came there, Jan Masaryk was killed. Or?
Benish.
Huh?
Was it Benish or Masaryk?
Masaryk.
Oh, he was thrown out the window.
He was thrown out of the window. And everything had changed. The people that I was able to talk to, the joint people, told me that everything changed. Everybody became silent. Nobody talked. Everybody realized. The world said, well, maybe he was pushed. The world, except for the people in joint, knew better, and everybody else knew better.
Slansky was a Jew who followed
the communist line.
Well, he was in fact the leader, and later executed. You don't remember anything about that?
No, I had no contact with him.
I didn't think so.
No, in Czechoslovakia, it was very, as I said, in every other community, I was introduced to the heads of the community and so forth, invited as a guest to the chambers of the, you know, the mayor's chambers or whatever it was called. But there, it was a very special arrangement. You knew that the environment was entirely different than it had been elsewhere.
Well, Austria was still under German control.
Austria was under joint control. It was under, it was like Berlin, it was divided up, and Austria, there was an American Austria, and there was a British Austria, and there was a French Austria.
Okay.
Coming back to this country was, of course, the next step along the way, and probably the most enjoyable week of my life was returning on the Queen, I guess it was Queen Mary, I don't remember, it was Elizabeth and Mary. It was the most luxurious experience that I have ever witnessed. As a matter of fact, I must say that I have since traveled on the Queen Elizabeth, and that was in recent years with my wife, and I was totally disappointed in the change, because there's no longer that elegant service, and that even after the war, there was the type of service and the elegance of shipboard travel cannot be compared or matched. I had a wonderful experience on the way back, in that I became friendly with a group, a traveling group that was called Carmen Miranda's Band. And they were not playing on the boat. They were just touring, as I was, returning from a job in Europe, and they were on their way really to a job in South America. So it was a wonderful experience. I met some interesting people. I met one man who was coming from Iran, who, it turns out, later, by showing how small the world is, purely by happenstance, turns out that his then brother-in-law is now one of my best friends from East Hampton, New York. When we met each other, we talked about people we knew in common, that sort of thing, and this was 30 years ago, and it turns out that his brother-in-law had been on the ship with me coming back. He was on his way back from Iran. He was an architect. But I came to New York, and as soon as I arrived, I was immediately approached by various people who wanted first-hand stories, wanted both laymen and professionals, and particularly journalists. So I gave out many interviews. Many of those were published in various Jewish publications and in lay publications. My thoughts and my impressions, and I still have some of those newspaper articles. That was an interesting experience. At that time, people were interested, if albeit for a short time. It didn't take long before people got on with their lives and did other things. But it was a great source of energy for me to go on to do what I had really wanted to do, and that was develop the young adult division and develop other young people to become interested in the pressing situation that existed.
Would you mind at this point, now that we've more or less covered that, to go to summarize your medical entry and practice steps in a broad brush way?
Well, I think that period of 3 months that I took off to go to Europe was following graduation, and then when I came back to do what everybody graduates medical school has to do. I had to intern. those days we did a rotating internship, and I did that at Montefiore Hospital in Pittsburgh. I followed the usual course of going through that, but interestingly, probably the only time in the history of such an internship, I would leave there, the hospital, for example, at 5 o'clock in the evening, get on a plane and go somewhere and make a speech, and then come back 4 o'clock in the morning, and then start to work. So, during my internship, I was actively involved. I got a lot of flack for that because there were a lot of heads of departments who were not too happy about an intern doing all these so-called extracurricular activities. But I spoke in Cincinnati and Cleveland and Chicago and St. Louis and Washington, D.C. and on my experiences in Europe. So it apparently was fruitful because young organizations were starting up. And I continued to do that. At that time, because of my interest in Jewish affairs, Sidney Bergman was head of the Montefiore Hospital. He urged me to specialize because it was his feeling that as a general practitioner, I would not be an effective leader of the Jewish community. Well, I made up my mind I was going to do general practice, and I did that. I didn't let anybody influence me. And I opened an office in Squirrel Hill, on the corner of Darlington and Murray Avenue. And I also opened an office on the corner of Sinner and Kirkpatrick. So I had two offices, one of which I shared with another friend, another physician, now deceased. And the reason I opened that office, because when I was in the medical school, my professor of medicine was a fellow by the name of Dr. Caldwell. And he said, if you really want to practice medicine, if you really want to do some good in the world, go into the Hill District and practice. You'll learn more medicine. And I did that. It was an interesting experience. It turned out not to be as fruitful from many points of view. For reasons I don't think are germane but to this discussion. But nonetheless, I opened two offices, and I practiced one in the morning and one in the afternoon, and I made house calls, and I did all those things that doctors no longer do. Summer of 1948. By the summer of 1950, I think it was, the Korean War broke out. And having not served in the military service as a physician, there was a special law passed in Congress requiring that physicians go into the military service as physicians.
You mentioned that.
We talked about that.
And I went, so I had to go into the service. And I went in as a captain in the Air Force. I went in as a lieutenant, became a captain, flight surgeon. Again went back to Europe, which was what I wanted to do because I wanted to revisit some of my haunts. There was considerable change. Europe, in those years between 1948 and, let's see, 1951, when I went back, there was considerable difference. Germany had not changed very much. Germany was still stagnating. We then went through, the years took us through the Berlin blockade, but there was amazing progress in Paris and most of Western Europe. But one of the most important, one of the things that impressed me more than anything else was the effect of the Marshall Plan on Europe. And we sometimes tend to forget what Truman did for this country, but I was in Europe at the time, and I remember the Marshall Plan started on May 15, 1948. I remember what an impact it had. Up until May 15, 1948, a pack of cigarettes was the most valuable thing a person could own. You could get a China set of great value for a carton of cigarettes, for example. On May 15th, the price of an American pack of cigarettes went down to 80 cents. So that it was an amazing effect. And Europe really started to progress. So I went back to Europe. I was a flight surgeon, and I spent 2 years there. I loved it. It was a wonderful experience. And then I came back here. But I learned one thing. I learned that we were a different world, a different country, and there was no interest in the subject of general practice. People didn't want general practitioners. As I said, I had an office in the Hill District, poor people. I had an office in Squirrel Hill, rich people. Nobody wanted a general practitioner. Everybody wanted a specialist. The poor people couldn't afford one or didn't know how to use one, and the rich people wanted a specialist. So I decided to specialize.
Now it's reverting back.
It's reverting back, exactly. Exactly. So I decided to specialize. At that time, I had been impressed by my exposure as an intern at Montefiore Hospital to a man by the name of Yale David Koskoff. We had a certain simpatico, and I think it was my interest, as was his, in psychiatry. And mine was a purely natural interest, as I think his was. And as a matter of fact, I then took up a residency in surgery at Montefiore, and he was the head of the hospital at that time. And he arranged for me to become a neurosurgeon by going to New York and studying at the Neurological Institute under Larry Poole, who was my preceptor. And I spent 3 years under his direction after spending 2 years under Koskoff in Pittsburgh. At that time, Montefiore Hospital was a busy, wonderful, progressive hospital. I always think back on what potential it had and how it went astray, how we lost that hospital to the Gentile community. But nonetheless, my personal experience was that Koskoff, who was medical director of the hospital, and Bergman, who was the administrative director of the hospital, wanted me to specialize so that I could take on a mantle or as a leader of the Jewish community in medicine. So when I went away, it was the plan for me to come back to Montefiore Hospital in neurosurgery and follow in Koskoff's footsteps.
I have a question. You're such a people person, and in my mind, a people person doesn't want to do surgery because I always think about surgeons as not a people person, but because you really don't deal too much with them.
Well, that may be. Personal. I don't know. I think maybe people have mixed personalities. I'd say that the best and the worst moments of my life have been operating. The most stressful of operating under seriously hazardous conditions of life and death. But certainly my great joy in life has always been operating and what can be accomplished with it. I think it has to do a lot with your inclination. I was never one to memorize formulas and drugs is something you would know about. I would never want to be involved with that kind of thinking. My thinking processes were always logical, reasonable, practical. And I think that surgery is that. I think surgery is very practical, especially. But nonetheless, I came back I spent 3 years as a neurological surgical resident at the Neurological Institute in New York. I had been here 2 years as a surgical and neurosurgical resident under Koskoff. And then I went to Boston. I spent time with a famous man there by the name of James Poppin. I spent 6 months assisting him at surgery. And then I went to Montefiore Hospital in the Bronx, and I did research in cerebrovascular diseases for about 2.5 years, during which time I was also on the teaching service and did neurosurgical teaching. So that by the time I finished that and came back to Pittsburgh, I had been away about a little over 6 years in specialty training, and I had 2 years of specialty training in Pittsburgh, so altogether, in order to be Commodore Surgeon, I had about 7.5 years of advanced training. When I came back to Pittsburgh, naturally, I went to Montefiore Hospital. I was admitted to the staff without question. That was always a problem in those days. But things had changed. The politics of the situation was such that now Koskoff became was no longer head of the hospital. He was now in private practice, and now we really, in effect, became competitors rather than colleagues. I started to do some research work at Montefiore. I had a couple of grants from the National Institutes of Health, and $200,000, and I did cerebral blood flow studies, radioactive cerebral blood flow studies on animals, and brought some of the first pseudovascular surgery to this area. It was interesting to me that Pittsburgh, though an advanced in many ways today, was not advanced in those days. And when I came back here, I was really surprised.